Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Guitar, an amazing instrument, and has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro, and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. It's good to have you here. We have a great show tonight. I'm really honored to have our guest here. Rosemary Butler is our guest tonight, and you probably know her more from her singing. She's worked with so many people and worked on so many important albums. It's just a mind-boggling to me. I mean, she's worked with Linda Ronstadt, James Taylor, Jackson Browne, Bonnie Raitt, Dolly Parton, Billy Joel, Bruce Springsteen, Whitney Houston, Bob Seger, Sarah Brightman, and on and on and on. Kenny Loggins, Michael McDonald, Joni Mitchell, Bette Midler. I mean, I have like another 20 names here, and she's worked on some amazing songs that you probably are very familiar with. Bonnie Raitt's Runaway, the Doobie Brothers' Minute by Minute, What a Fool Believes, Jackson Browne, The Pretender, Running on Empty, James Taylor, You've Got a Friend, the duet he did with Carole King, Linda Ronstadt, Adios, Get Closer, You're No Good, Just One Look. I mean, these are amazing songs. Kenny Loggins, Conviction of the Heart, one of my favorites. Bette Midler, The Rose, classic. And Boss Gags, Look What You've Done to Me. I mean, these are amazing things. But even more amazing than that, I mean, that's amazing enough, is she was in a group, one of the groups that pretty much opened the door for women rock bands. Now, we had a few months ago, I had June Millington on a Fanny, and she mentioned in her book this group called Bertha. And Rosemary was the bass player and vocalist for Bertha. And
hi, y'all.
It's great. I mean, that alone, just like, that's part of history. To me, that's very, very significant. And we're going to play some clips of Bertha, which she hasn't heard in a little while.
That's right.
And it's amazing. I mean, some of her bass playing is just, it's unreal. But first what I want to play is a little bit of her newest album. This is You Just Watch Me. Now, we were going to have, if you've followed on Facebook, I had mentioned that she was coming on with Maitland Ward. And Maitland had called me over the weekend. He got one of these quick emergency gigs that he had to do. He does arrangements, besides being a great guitar player. And he's all you're going to hear him in a minute off of this album. So he got a call, and it was like one of these things, you know, around the clock. He had to turn it over really fast. So no problem. We'll have Maitland on later. I promised I would have him come back, and so we'll have him on. I'll talk more about that because he's a killer guitar player.
Yes, he is.
And you're going to hear that in a minute. So the first thing I want to do to kind of set the scene is on from her new album, You Just Watch Me, is this is a very cool song. And Maitland's playing guitar. So is Michael Stern, if mm-hmm. I have it right. David Lindley's playing slide. And Leland Scar on bass. Not too shabby. These guys, you all know.
The homeboys.
Yes. And so I'm going to play this clip, and it's called New Mexico Cadillac. And it's just beautiful stuff. Thank you.
just how my life would go. Till the day I saw the plates from New Mexico. It had bright red flames painted down the side and the silent red. God bless this ride. The bluest eyes I'd ever seen looking out at me into my dreams. Well, there's a real new mirror, but you can't look back in that New Mexico Cadillac.
Now, I had originally picked songs to kind of show also too Maitland's playing, but I mean your voice is fantastic as it
is.
Thank you. And she has a 4-octave range, so we're going to talk a little bit about that. We're going to kind of go beyond the bass guitar, but I want to talk. We're going to talk about her playing with Bertha. But I just wanted to mention this album has, and you're going to hear some other clips that I'm going to play. There's just some killer guitar playing throughout the whole thing. All these guys that are playing on her, Maitland, Michael, David, they're just killer players. And she has guest vocalists. She has Jackson Brown and Kenny Loggins on the album, which is not too shabby. It's great stuff. But now I want to talk about Bertha, which they came. Their albums were released in 72 and 73. The Bertha, it was the first one, and then Can't Stop the Madness.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm going to pull a clip here. This is from, and now she hasn't heard this for a while.
Oh, my goodness.
So we're going to have a little bit of a reminiscing thing here. But this, kind, it starts out with a bass solo. So I'm going to, for the intro, this is a song called Fine Talking Man, and just check out this bass playing and her tone, and we're going to talk a little bit about the gear. So this is Fine Talking Man. Now, you might have heard a little bit, we were talking over the music a little bit. She wrote this. You wrote this.
I think so, yeah. It was a long time ago, but yeah.
And you guys, what else? You were mentioning that you were in high school when you did this?
Yeah, well, we were, the guitar player and I met in high school, and when we were playing in high school, I think I was like a sophomore or something when I first got in the band, and everybody was going to be going to their prom, and we were opening for the Stones.
That's their, right, in 64, yeah.
64. In our first, you know, first American tour with them, and the next day, everybody came back, and they had their prom picture, and here's my corsage, and this is my dress, and we were selling Mick Jagger's cigarette butts.
That must have been, well, what was that like? I mean, that must have been, because that was what, that was like 1964 or something like
you
that?
You know, people ask me about dates. I don't know. I just know that.
I mean, was it pretty crazy backstage? Because that was like Beatlemania time. People
yes.
were like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, when the Stone, we were playing an outdoor venue. It was in Stockton.
Oh, wow.
And when the Stones came on the, you know, made their arrival, the stage was in the middle of the grass. And the Stones came around in a Brinks truck, you know.
Oh, wow.
And everybody in those days sat in the bleachers. They were not allowed on the grass. And when they played, because our manager had booked it, we got to be, like, right up on the stage, you know, and watch them. And the night before when we went to the hotel, they came to our room, and they probably thought, oh, this will be easy. And we wouldn't let them in. That's why we collected the cigarette butts, because we thought, well, you know, these are probably worth something. You know? But they... I remember when they did This Could Be the Last Time, they made everybody run out of their seats and charge the stage. And we were standing right by the stage, and we ducked underneath the stage because we had never seen that happen. We were really scared.
Oh, know? Yeah.
And they were jumping on them and pulling their hair and grabbing their guitars. I mean, it was violent. It wasn't like, oh, I'm so happy to meet you, Mick. It was more like, I want to grab your hair. And, you know, it was mostly young boys
mm-hmm.
that you know, did that. And then they got in the Brinks truck and ran out of there. It was like, I think this has happened before.
Well, I think even when you see, like, the Beatles at Madison Square Garden, there's fences.
Yeah.
So they made more barriers. Back then, I'm sure, they just put the stage in the center of the field. Didn't even think about that. And when they rushed, it's like, there's nothing you could do.
Nothing you could do. It was scary.
Yeah, it could, I mean, I've heard stories.
It's like a mob scene.
Even the Beatles mentioned that. It could be very dangerous then. But it's interesting because before there was merchandising, you were already merchandising the cigarette butts. Because there wasn't, back then there were no t-shirts, there was none of that stuff.
That's right.
But you were there. Yeah. You were at another milestone. That's great. But
no corsage.
No corsage. But I want to ask you, I'm going to play another clip, and this one features you and Shell, if I'm pronouncing it right, Pinizzotto, who unfortunately passed away in 2014.
Yeah.
But a great guitar player. I mean, she was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
But there's a jam between you guys in this clip, and this is called Forgotten Soul. And then I want
to
talk a little bit about what you were using this
in a long time.
Forgotten Soul. So let me take a listen to this.
Oh, baby.
Now, that's just great. I mean, remember, everybody, this is 1972. I'm just blown away. I mean, that's some great, that's a great, you know, the bass playing is killer.
Well,
you did a great job.
Thank you.
And Shell's guitar playing, that's
She was outrageous.
She was, I mean, that's as good as anybody that was, I mean, at that time, you know, she was holding her own. That's pretty aggressive rock playing. I mean, yeah. I mean, going through these two albums, I had to find them. It's hard to get them. They're not on CD anymore. And it was interesting hearing all the stuff because compared to what I had heard before, like with Fanny, it was much edgier. Your stuff was much edgier and harder. I mean, more driven rock. I mean, you cranked up guitars. I mean, they played loud and stuff too. But I mean, we're going to talk about that in a minute. The groove. We were talking a little bit before the show. But I want to ask you, you were a lefty.
Yep.
And what did you use? What was your equipment back then?
Oh, well, I had, you know, of course, a Hofner. And I had a Fender. I had Jazz, and I had a Precision, and I had a Rickenbacker, and I had a Gibson.
Do you still have all those?
I think I have just one bass now. I have a Fender.
The Jazz?
Yeah.
Because that's the one I've seen, any pictures I've seen of you, that's usually you with the Jazz bass.
Yeah, I have a sweet spot for Fender.
Yes. Well, tell us that. This is a really interesting story. She was explaining this to me before the show, and I think it's talk about things being meant. Go ahead and tell us about this.
Well, when I was, I don't know, seven, somewhere between five and seven, we lived in Fullerton, and my sister and brothers and I would be in the backyard playing while my mom was cleaning the house. And my brothers would play Army Men, and my other brother liked to. We had a little tree house, and my sister would play Baby Dolls, and she would, like, you know, dress them up, and they mm-hmm. feed them, and then, you know, and I was like, I am so out of here. So I climbed the fence, and I went. I went across the railroad tracks, and I was just having a great old time. I just wanted to, you know, see what was out there. And there was a orange grove, and there was this Fender plant where they made the guitars and all that. And so I just walked up, and I started talking to the very talented craftsman. And they, you know, put me next to them, like on their lap or in a seat next to them or something. And they would tell me all these stories, and they'd say, oh, this is a very special lacquer. And this is like a really cool sunburst pick guard. And you know, and they would say, now, when you look down the neck here, you can tell if it's got any bows in it. You know, and they were like really teaching me about the creation of the guitar. And I saw the first guitar pickup that was ever invented, and it was just interesting. And once they got the guitar done, they would play it for me, you know, and I just thought it was the coolest thing. They had a whole room of left-handed instruments there, and when I finally started playing in high school, I got to go there, and they helped me pick out, like, oh, that's a really cool neck right there. That one is like, you know.
So you were able to pick yours from the factory.
Yeah, and they had never been used. They were like the original ones, and the bass, and they sanded it down because, you know, I have little hands. I mean, not little hands, but they're girl hands, you know.
Yeah, well, no, the Jazz bass would be perfect for you because it was a narrower neck. But did you ever talk to Leo Fender?
I never met him, no.
He wasn't there.
No, no. But I had Fender amps, and I had, you know, everything. Whatever was the style that week, or whoever I loved as a bass player, I had all their equipment, you know. I was interested in trying the different sounds and stuff.
Now, when you played live, did you use a bunch of Fenders, or did you go to more powerful amps?
Oh,
because you guys had to be pretty loud to get that sound.
We were so loud. I remember playing on the pier in Venice. Okay, this was when Venice used to have a pier at POP, Pacific Ocean Park. And it was the first time we had done a concert, and Michael... what was his name? He played the keyboards. He did that song, Let's Go Get Stoned. Michael...
Was he in a group?
He was an artist. But anyway, so here we had these Marshalls, right?
Mm-hmm.
Stacks of Marshalls. And we didn't really know what we were doing. And so we would plug in and we'd put it on 10.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't even hear the drummer. I couldn't hear the other players. But I thought, wow, this is so cool. And it's so loud. And I'd be standing there singing, and my pants were like shaking in the breeze from the vibrations of the amp. And I thought that was like really neat because I didn't know what I was doing. And then during the Flower Power period, we had... we were the Daisy Chain at that time, and so Shelley had like a one of those little tiny Renaults, and she painted a whole bunch of daisies mm-hmm. all over it. And we used to wear psychedelic long robes that glowed in the dark. And
oh, that's cool! And you had black lights on the stage.
Yes, we did.
That was a big deal back then.
Oh, hey, it was happening, and strobe lights, and you know. All of that stuff. We were really.
I'm trying to figure out who is. I'm looking up the song "Let's Go Get Stoned." Manfred Mann did it. The Amboy Dukes.
It was a Michael something.
Joe Cocker, Derek Trucks Band, Billy Preston, Lil Folsom, James Brown, Booker T and the MGs.
No.
It doesn't say Michael Spork. Sporky?
No. Never mind.
Anyway, I'm trying to...
Anyway, we were using, you know, their equipment because we didn't own Marshalls at the time. But it was so thrilling. But anyway, I tried everything. I've read all about... I used to work at Fullerton Music
mm-hmm.
in the store. And so I'd be, like, selling, you know, all these cool... instruments.
And you could demo them, too.
And I'd go, okay, and this is what this sounds like, and this is what this sounds like, and you're going to love this because, you know.
Now, what did you use in the studio? You use the Fenders and the Fender amps?
Depends on what year it was.
Well, let's look at Bertha, 1972.
Probably album. Fender, yeah. Yeah, that was my special one, and it had a... I had a boyfriend who had put on a rose on his... arm that was a tattoo,
mm-hmm.
and then he tattooed into my back of my face the same tattoo. So
very cool.
I really like it.
Well, that's about the time when everybody started painting their guitars and doing certain really cool stuff. So that's actually...
It makes it personal.
Yes. Now, I'm going to play another clip, and I'm going to ask you about this because I felt... I've never heard... This type of a groove, it reminded me a lot of the James Gang. And there was a certain type of drumming type of thing that's happening here. And it was like, wow, that sounds like... And I knew that you guys came out around the same time as the James Gang, but you guys actually knew the James Gang.
Oh, yeah.
So let me play this groove because it's very interesting. Listen to what the drummer's doing. This is called Too Much Woman. And it's an interesting rhythm track here. It really moves. Hold on, here we go. And I mean, if you're familiar with the James Gang, like Funk 49 or whatever, it's that kind of groove. That her, she's great. That was Olivia, right? Olivia
Favela. Yeah, we called her Liver.
liver. But man, I mean, that just stood out. As soon as I heard that, I'm like, it's like, wow. They had to have known somebody, but you guys knew them.
Yeah, and I still, keep in touch with Joe Walsh. And I admire him so much. I think he's really a great
player. Now, I was trying to find more information on liver. Where was she? Was she a native of California? Was she originally from here, or is she from back east?
Well, I don't really know, but she was from, I think, Orange County.
Oh, okay. Because I was just curious if that feel, because he's from the Midwest.
Yeah, no, I don't think she was from the Midwest.
I mean, that's incredible. And it's tight. And then also, too, the vocals. All you guys are pretty strong vocalists. That's another thing that you didn't see a lot. I mean, it's some groups like the Moody's or the Beatles, they were all, they all could hold their own. But, I mean, everybody, when you're doing those harmonies, you guys are belting, and that's not easy to do, to that be that tight and that, powerful.
Well, thank you.
So, but anyway, that was interesting. But it's just that when I heard that, I'm like, God, that drumming is just like the James game. So now what I want to do is I'm going to play something again from the new album, just to kind of show, because you can see where I'm trying to show where she was coming from and where she is now on the new album. And this piece is a great funky groove. This has Maitland on guitar and Michael Stern on guitar and Randall Tico on bass. And so I'm going to play this clip and we're going to go back and forth a little bit. And I got some other Bertha clips here.
Oh, that's so funny.
We got more. But this one's called Never Be Rocked Enough. So let me Me, I can't spell.
No, it's okay.
But anyway, that's right. Never been rocked enough. But let me take a listen. This is a great groove.
I watch you come in here night after night. You sit over in the corner where there ain't no light. You got a beautiful smile, but you don't have fun.
Just great.
An old bar rag, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's a great tune. It's a great tune, and it kind of shows you can hear a little bit of your Bertha-ness in there. Because I mean, there's some really beautiful stuff that you're doing on the album, and I have to mention you have a 4-octave range. That's pretty amazing in itself. And primarily now after Bertha, you've been on call for vocals all the time. And I mentioned, some of the names of some of the different things that you had done. But it was really interesting. That groove, that's just a tight. I like that. I love
that's
that.
That's Delbert McClinton.
Yeah.
I found out about him when I was working with Bonnie Raitt.
Mm-hmm.
And I met Bonnie Raitt through this guy named Catfish Hodge, who was this freckle-faced, red-haired blues singer.
Mm-hmm.
He opened for Bertha, and we struck up a real good friendship, and we used to get together and eat pies all the time. And he said, I want you to come and sing on my record, and Bonnie was also singing on it, so he put us together. And that's when I kind of found my sound.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bonnie wanted me to sing on her record. And then through Bonnie, I met, the Eagles and Jackson Browne and Linda Ronstadt and James Taylor and all kinds of people through her. She was my mentor.
Mm-hmm. Well, you worked with them and the Doobie Brothers. You got into it, and Michael McDonald. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a whole slew of people. You were in that basic Warner Brother group of session people, which was kind of like a little clique of different people.
It was, yeah. And we did the No Nukes thing. It was with Jackson. We did a whole year of touring around nuclear power plants.
Oh, wow.
And
you didn't need to wear those glowing
glowing white things
from Bertha because you were glowing. Right? But that's incredible. Now the stuff I played so far was from 72 Bertha. Then in 73 you did another album which was much more expansive. You guys were getting into much more. I mean, the reviews that I've read from the sites, the Bertha sites, talked about the fact that you guys really expanded a lot, and a lot of people liked the second album even more than the first album. Though I thought the first album was just pretty solid. But I'm going to play a couple of things real quick to kind of give you a feel, and then I want to ask you more of the vibe of that album, what was happening.
Okay.
First I'm going to play is, because I love her bass playing, I'm going to play a bass solo that you did, and this is called Can't Stop the Madness. So let me play that first.
I haven't heard this in so long. That's Shelley singing.
That's pretty amazing stuff. I mean, I love that bass line. That's a great bass line.
Oh, thank you.
So now I noticed. Now that sounded like you were playing with a pick.
Yeah.
Right. Now, when you played live, did you use a pick or did you use fingers?
I used everything.
So you would change.
My feet. No. No, I mean, you know, I tried everything.
No. Oh, okay.
Fat picks, hard picks.
But you can hear in that song. That's the title song of the album. But you can hear musically, you guys expanded. I mean, obviously, probably from touring and meeting all the different people, you can hear the influence. You guys were spreading out and branching out on a lot of different things. So I want to, before I start talking about how you approach the album, I want to play one other thing which has a bass riff in it too, but it's another song from that album. It's called Don't Let It Get You Down. Here we go.
You better keep your feet on the ground. Sooner or later, you're gonna be
So anyway, that gives you a little more feel. I mean, it's a great what you did with the bass. It's just really cool.
I
mean,
you.
I'm just nudging you to play more bass. So.
All right. Okay.
Next album, okay?
All right.
Bass. Okay. He's going to play bass on
it. My band is always yelling at me, too.
No, I mean...
You got to play it.
But you do some really great things. Now, the first album, probably a lot of that music from the first album was, you know, you guys had been playing that live, if I'm correct. So you had already been playing it.
Yeah.
And it feels kind of like a live album. But what happened with the second album? Were you guys...
We had Paul Rothchild.
Ah.
Was our producer. And he also did Janis Joplin. And Bonnie Raitt, and I mean, he was just amazing. He really took us to a whole nother level. Really brilliant guy.
So you kind of, did you guys collaborate more with him with the songs and make, or did you guys have the idea of what you wanted to do with the song, and then he embellished it, or was it like a?
Well,
did you guys work together? Because it's an interest. Because it's a noticeable difference, and
yeah.
It's. Though it still makes sense. I mean, I can see, you know, I can hear more influences. And at that time, who you must have been, you know, hanging out with and stuff, it definitely had an impact. But, I mean, it was amazing. And the album is really adventurous. I mean, there's a lot of early progressive rock things that you were doing in some of the other clips or some of the other music on the album. They're actually doing some really cool stuff that,
thank you.
Know, around that time. You know, progressive rock was just starting to happen, and there was a lot, you know, some...
Well, we lived together, and when we toured, a lot of times, there were four of us in one room, you know, so you get really close, and, you know, we would have the same dreams, you know, we'd wake up and, wow, I just had a dream about this song, and the other person would go, yeah, I know, and I mean, we were constantly together, constantly, we had... A real group focus,
mm-hmm.
you know, and direction.
But I mean, there's some really cool. I mean, on the Can't Stop the Madness, the lowering down of the organ and all that stuff. That's really cool stuff. And the guitar effects. I mean, Shelley was doing some really nice stuff.
Yeah, she was. And, you know, she tried every guitar and every effect that there was. I mean, you know, we tried everything. That was our whole life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we just lived and breathed it.
Well, let me ask you then, though, what were your influences? What did you listen to even before, I mean, even before Bertha, when you were in the Ladybirds,
mm-hmm.
Who did you listen to for bass?
Oh, Carole King. I mean, Carole K.
Carole K, okay.
You know, all the great bass players. I studied them, you know, and Prakash. Who was the Indian man that played bass with the James Gang, was a teacher of mine.
Oh, wow.
And, I mean, you know, I would just spend so many hours just with listening to music and trying to learn licks and chops and feels and you know, I mean, I was in love with music. That's... what I married.
Mm-hmm.
You
yeah,
know,
yeah.
That
no,
was
I
that's all I wanted to do, and I loved to jam, and I loved to play different styles and write songs, and, you know, it was all I could think of. You know, I wasn't thinking, well, maybe you should get married and have kids, and, you know, I was like, I don't think so.
But now, vocally, who did you listen to? What were your influences vocally?
Well, when I was listening to that Bertha song, I remember how... influenced I was by Janis Joplin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I only saw her once, and I was just like, what is she doing? She's committing suicide on stage or something. I mean, it was just so raw and so exciting. And, I mean, of course, I liked Aretha, and I liked, you know, all the greats. I got to meet some of them. But, you know, all kinds of singing. I mean, I had really extensive training because of all the producers that I worked with and then all of the artists that I toured with and worked with and stuff. And I would train with their trainers,
mm-hmm.
you know, people from the Met and, you know, people that had taught them things. And
so you had classical training, too.
Well, yeah, but, you know, they taught me where you know, like a, let's say you're at a huge event, a big concert, and you have the flu, you know, and you have to go on, and there are tricks in order to professionally limp, you know, to get through shows and belt mm-hmm. and do all that stuff without hurting your voice, even though you're sick.
Right.
You know, and yeah, I mean, I sang for Sarah Brightman.
Mm-hmm.
She did a like a contemporary album, not opera. They had me do all the guide vocals for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I sang, you know, some stuff with orchestras when Linda Ronstadt, you know, had a rehearsal with an orchestra. She didn't like to go to sound checks. So she'd let me do it, and I'd go.
That's cool.
Okay, yeah, I'll do that. And it was really a great experience. And Bette Midler was one of my students. And, you know, because we sang On the Rose, she was doing an album. And so I ran into her at, I think it was Graham Nash's party,
mm-hmm.
and she said, you know, I'm trying to think of what the next album should be, and she had, like, this, I mean, I always loved her voice, and I always thought she was so hysterical and funny and everything, and so I worked training her, and she said, oh, you know, I'm going to do a tribute to Rosemary Clooney. Because she had just died, and Linda was introduced to the jazz world by Rosemary Clooney. It took her under her wing. Mm-hmm. She was like a musical mother to her. And so I introduced the two of them, and then they did that song, Sisters.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Barry Manilow was the producer. Somewhere I have a cassette of him singing both parts. Sisters. And and so then Bette said, well, you know, I don't want to make everybody have to do it again if I make a mistake, so will you lead the orchestra? And I said, yeah, I will, you know. And so I got these interesting, you know, things just because of what I was, you know.
Yeah, that's not a standard session, just to, like, it's almost like a movie stand-in. You're like a stand-in for the album.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I mean, just really fortunate and lucky to be in the right place. When I was singing with Bonnie Raitt, we did Alan Toussaint's record,
mm-hmm.
and it was Etta James and Bonnie Raitt and me. But, you know, everybody was signed to a label, and so we couldn't use our real names.
Mm-hmm.
But we had to put Etta James way off in the back of the studio and baffle her because she's not a harmony singer. She's like, you know, and so anyway, she was doing her album, and she said, do you want to come and watch me do my vocals? And I said, yeah, I would like to. And so it was just her and me. And, you know, she's in the room and she's singing, and, you know, I'm engineering, not engineering, but, you know, basically kind of like producing her vocals and learning how to do that. And she'd go, well, how did that sound? And I went, well, you know, there's this one note. I thought, power! And I love to produce. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Love to produce.
Now, I just want to mention the people. She was talking about Barry Manilow. A lot of people don't know that Barry Manilow was the music director for Bette for years before he broke as an artist, and he was writing songs. I mean, he wrote one of the commercials for McDonald's. And
oh,
stuff.
Big time.
This is years before he broke, you know, with his career.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he was one of those behind-the-scene guys, too.
Yeah, and, you know, I got to watch Linda go through all of these different genre changes, you know. Can you imagine? Now she's not even singing in English, you know.
Well, she and Joni Mitchell, I always admired them because they would take risks and go somewhere else. I mean, Don Juan's Reckless Daughter, which was pretty out there for an album at the time when Joni released that. Mm-hmm. You know, she had Jaco playing bass on that. It was amazing. It was really jazzy.
Oh, yeah.
But I thought that even Linda, too, she took risks, and they were successful risks. I mean, it's
amazing.
They always were pushing their craft, and I think that's important.
And you always knew it was Linda.
Yeah.
You know? And they had to learn how to become that style. And it was fascinating to watch how they did it.
Yeah.
You know? Because you kind of have to divorce the way that you used to do it.
Right, right.
You know, and it's like, oh my God, it's a whole new beat. It's a whole new genre. It's a whole new, you know, me.
But when you were doing sessions, and mm-hmm. as you start doing more as a vocalist, session vocalist, were a lot of those what we call head charts, where you would sit down, or were they written?
Both.
Both.
Like David Foster would be very written. You don't even get your first note.
What about Kenny?
Kenny Loggins.
Was that written, or were those head charts?
Some of it was written.
Because it seemed like there was some pretty complex
harmonies. Oh, yeah, he's very complex. But he can sing it, and I can hear it and do it, you know. But
right.
But when you have big choirs and stuff, we did this one thing with Celine. Remember when 9-1-1 happened,
mm-hmm.
and they had that big benefit thing where they just had like candles,
right?
And these artists were singing, and it was on all of the radio television stations at once, and all that. Well, we actually did those harmonies with Celine. The whole track, you know, was done in L.A. But
no, I want to just mention real quick that that term. You'd be in a session, the vocalist would come in and hear the song, and they literally would build the parts, and that's what they called the head charts. They would just do it right there, and they would sit down and, okay, you do this, that. Okay, run it. I mean, it was like, you know, like you would expect a guitarist to maybe improvise on a section or something like that. And it was, there were groups of singers like yourself that were known to do that, that did it really well and it was amazing because some of the stuff that you're talking about is not that simple harmonically in some mm-hmm. of the lines and how you know, but they were just amazing. I mean, it's like it's similar to like a lot of the string players used to play in Nashville. There were no written charts.
Mm-hmm.
They would sit there and say, okay, they just knew.
Yeah.
And they would play together like that. But that's where the term head chart came from. And it's when you've seen somebody that really knows how to do it, it's amazing.
Oh, it is intuitive. You know, it's like writing a song or something. You just hear it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to work with Crosby, Stills, and Nash and on different things with Jackson and also the Eagles. And I did some touring with Graham. And you know, their harmonies are really complex, but they kind of have freedom within the harmonies
mm-hmm.
because they can, you know, it's not like barbershop where somebody's always on the bottom, somebody's always in the middle, and somebody's always on the top. They would switch around, you know, in the middle of things, and you're going, whoa. And so Graham, whenever he would get excited and want to, you know, have some passion or something, he would switch to the top part instead of the melody. And I had to get out of the way really fast. I was like,
well,
he
could sing pretty high. He did most of the high parts
a lot of high parts.
Yeah.
But he was singing lead now.
Yeah.
You know.
But it's amazing, though, their voices, the magic, the way they would blend.
Oh.
Must have been fun to sing with.
Oh, it was. And I really think it was Crosby who had the magic glue. When they got him, his voice, the way that he sings, it's like the dressing.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It just makes everything work, you know, instead of, okay, there's a meat patty, you got some cheese and some bread.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like when you get the dressing in there, it's like, ooh. It's a sandwich. You know what I mean?
Right. And that once the three of them, they would just, that blend was just
stunning. And the Eagles, too.
Yeah. They had their harmonies were just stellar. They were just really.
Oh, they were so stellar.
So, but no, you worked with some of these people you're talking about. Just some of the vocal things that you guys did were just incredible.
Yeah. It was really fun. We did, Glenn Frey at the opening party of the Super Bowl, and that was so fun. Oh my goodness, I've never seen so many drunk people in my life. Oh my god! And they had a huge tent, and we could go in there and pick any kind of, you know, sports clothes or, you know, hats or jackets or t-shirts or anything, you know, and it was, that was a wild gig. It was really something. But I liked working with Glenn. He had us up to his ranch. He has this beautiful ranch in Colorado with a studio, you know, where it's out looking out at like a little brook going by in the mountains, and there's a fireplace, and it's just so perfect, and a little bunkhouse for the musicians and stuff. And you know, a lot of the touring that I did that was out of the country, you know, like Brazil or Australia, New Zealand, you know, Japan, a lot of it was with James Taylor. And I learned so much from him. I was with him for 9 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. We did a lot of a cappella stuff, too.
Well, we're already out of time. But I just want to mention that if you're ever at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, there's a clip of Jackson Browne playing Running on Empty, and you're singing on it, which I think is amazing.
I have to go there and see that.
Now, you're going to be doing another album. You had mentioned, there was a little bit at the beginning when we were playing the first clip, you mentioned something. So when can we expect that?
All right. Well, you know, the way that I got this album done was I was doing a house concert. And it was the first time I'd done a house concert as a solo artist with Russ and Julie. And in the audience, this guy comes up and he goes, "Oh, I really like the show, and I'd like to buy your CD." And I said, "Oh, well, you know, I sang on a lot of records, but I don't have a solo CD. I mean, I did one for ABC Dunhill years ago, and I was signed to Capitol, and I did some stuff in Japan and France, and had a couple gold records in Japan. I had a great time there. But anyway, so I said, you know, I don't really have a CD. And he goes, "Oh, we'll have to see what we can do about that." And so he funded it.
This one's called You Just Watch Me, and it's available everywhere. And but you're going to have to come back with the new album.
Oh, yeah. Well,
and you promised that you'll play bass.
Oh, okay.
I'm holding you to that.
Okay, okay.
So.
And so anyway, he is just building a whole new studio. And so he said, "Let's do another record." So I'm very grateful for that.
No, you gotta do a couple of rockers, because you really just have the voice for that too. I mean, besides the other stuff, I mean, your voice is just great. It's, you know, you can do almost anything, but man, when you really stomp it, you really stomp it.
Thank you.
This album is great. It's called
You
Just Watch Me. And I want to thank Lori for putting us together. Now, Lori, you had mentioned there was something coming up. She's playing out?
There's actually two things coming up. One is Rose's next gig, her next solo gig, which is going to be in Santa Barbara at a place called Soho. And that's on May 15th.
May 15th.
A couple weeks from now. And she'll be back there with her band most of who played on the album. So
including
really
Maitland.
Cool. Yeah. And Randy.
And what was the other
Eddie
gig?
Story. And then we're doing a benefit show, which is actually a tribute with many local professional musicians and star singers. And Rosemary is one of the people who will be singing on it. And the theme is the California saga, the California sound. So many of the artists who she actually performed with are songs that we'll be doing in the show.
Okay.
And that's going to be on two nights, actually, June 24th. And June 25th at the El Rey Theater.
Okay. All right.
It is so fun. We did a big Beach Boy tribute.
Oh, that should
Christmas
be fun.
Christmas thing.
Talking about harmonies.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, thank you both for coming on the show. And
our pleasure. Thank you.
I'm going to close with a clip from her new album. It's an interesting song. I'm going to play it's called Clown Funky.
And it's, Maitland, that's for you.
That's for Maitland. Everybody, have a great night, and thank you so much
thank
for being
you
on the show.
Guys. You guys. We should mention Kevin Wax as her executive director of the executive producer of the album, and also the executive director of the tribute that we've been doing
He's
for
a drummer.
Oh,
very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. Everybody, have a great night. Here's Clown Funky.
It's Clown Funky. Funky, I can make it. Yeah, baby. Ha ha ha.